Hello there, and welcome back to Peace in Their Time, episode 172, The First 100 Days, Part 1. Finally, we've reached the part where FDR is actually in office. He was pumped up, the people were pumped up, he had Congress in the palm of his hand, and he had a plan. Wait, stop. He had a plan, right? 4-month lame duck period plus the entire campaign season means there must have been some kind of plan in place. Well, not necessarily, actually. There were plans, plural, but maybe not an overarching, comprehensive blueprint to be worked from. And no, I'm not saying the concept of the New Deal was fake or even overblown, but I am saying that the idea of it is probably a bit more complicated than what my American listeners got in high school. The term New Deal stemmed from a campaign phrase uttered by Roosevelt to emphasize that what he was going to do would be a break from the past. And he would absolutely deliver on that, and in a positive way to boot. Which on this show, that's no guarantee. It's just that his administration, especially during the famous first 100 days that we're going to be covering for the next few weeks, were a very big break from the past. So big, in fact, that there was a running debate over how far they were going to go from the first moments FDR positioned himself to run for the presidency up through pretty much the whole of the 30s. The internal debates never really stopped, and, well, the public ones certainly didn't either. And the reason was because the programs and reforms that were implemented went further than any other administration before it had gone. Well, that and the fact there wasn't a whole lot set down in stone at first, so as we'll cover, much of the legislation of the first 100 days was a bunch of shooting from the hip. And I am going to get one thing out of the way before we get off to the races. The New Deal wasn't a perfect set of plans, especially at the beginning, which, just to temper expectations, the rest of this miniseries is going to be covering the New Deal from 1933 to around the end of 1934, a little bit past that, but around then. To the midterm elections, basically. The reason I'm doing it this way is because I'm trying to not spend 30 episodes one place, much like why I kept the past Soviet miniseries brief, and risking you, the listener, out. And more importantly, risk burning myself out. So, the next 10 episodes will be covering what has been referred to as the First New Deal. And when we come back to the United States, I'll cover the second phase of it. Fun fact about the Second New Deal, it was a lot more successful than the first, or at least it didn't have as many embarrassing failures. And I bring that up to point out that the New Deal's start was unprecedented, and even the talented and experienced people Roosevelt tapped to staff his team kinda had to make things up as they went along. FDR himself certainly did. But the results of those ventures were not always good, and while the first three episodes here are mostly going to be discussing how the reforms came together and what they intended to do, the rest of the miniseries will be covering their effects in practice, which I'm going to come out and just say, it was kind of a mixed bag there at the start. But anyway, FDR and his team immediately set out to break with a long tradition of light-touch American governance upon taking power. And while the enormity of what they were about to embark upon didn't scare them off, it did give many a reason for pause. Yes, even with circumstances as dire as they were, people around FDR, figures in Congress, even FDR himself, stopped to consider the past they were breaking from, and if they were making the right decision. In the case of FDR, it kind of became an annoyance for his team, because whatever their reservations were, most recognized that they had to go boldly into the unknown. The aristocratic Roosevelt, though, steeped in how the United States had functioned up to that point and very much plugged into the elite circles that had benefited from that, hesitated a bit once he finally hit the threshold of actually making the changes he had been talking about. It probably didn't help that he had been in the mix during the burst of progressivism in the first part of the century, during the Woodrow Wilson days, and doubtless remembered the rocks that Wilson and the entire movement had dashed themselves against politically after World War I. If he wasn't careful, the same thing could happen to him. A public backlash at government overreach could sink not only his administration, but the reborn progressive movement that he had led into power as well. That all being said, as much as he vacillated, FDR realized he didn't have much of a choice. Hoover's assertions to the contrary, if the nation were to survive, decisive and extended action would be needed. Even if it was a little incoherent, sometimes even a little half-baked, the New Deal was going to be what the nation needed to pull itself back together. And I think it's worth talking about up front just what the New Deal means in the context of this show and more broadly to the United States. It isn't exactly a coincidence that I'm covering the New Deal immediately after the first five-year plan of the Soviet Union. I think comparing the two provides a nice little contrast in approach. Not that the two are remotely similar, I am very much comparing apples to oranges here. There are two very different programs that played out in two very different contexts. What I'm getting at is that despite the New Deal being a notable break from the past of the United States and creating a much more expansive central government, it was not a revolutionary package of reforms. If its proponents promised to drive the money changers from the temple, so to speak, it was only to save them from themselves. There was no question of overthrowing the capitalist order. Instead, it was designed to curb its worst excesses so that it could survive. Sure, the business class wouldn't have the same carte blanche in how they operated previously, but they would be preserved. And yes, normal people affected by the Depression would have access to government work programs and welfare on a scale never before imagined in the United States, but that was to keep the population from reaching levels of destitution where they would consider doing an uprising against the elites. I'm not going to be making a lot of references from here on out between the two. I'll let the New Deal's achievements stand for themselves. But unlike what a lot of conservative revisionists have posited in the past 90 years, it was not a stepping stone to something more radical. It was the medicine administered to a system that, if left unattended, would very quickly destroy itself. Many of the New Deal's paladins, years later, would ruefully recall how in those fateful early days, they could have overhauled the nation far more than they had. If not the entire economy, then certainly the connective tissues like the railroads and the banking sector, those all could have been nationalized and placed into public control. Now, this isn't to be dismissive of the New Deal either. In a nation as conservative as the United States, and the U.S. is a very conservative country, the achievements are remarkable. There have been depressions in the U.S. before, notably the 1873-79 depression that had previously held the title Great before the 1929 crisis dethroned it. And the 2008 disaster should be properly categorized as a depression, but is referred to as a recession for PR purposes. In neither the older nor the newer case did any significant change to the relationship between people and state occur, other than lingering bitterness, of course. Things did change in this case, which probably should speak to the scale of the crisis, which, again, I have taken pains to describe in previous episodes, but I can never properly make you feel as people felt at that time, how they felt such despair, such fear, such uncertainty. But regardless of the success or failure, the fact that the New Deal happened in a place like the U.S. is remarkable in and of itself. The last point I'll bring up is that for this show, the long-term effect of the New Deal was to keep the U.S. from falling into anarchy, which was a distinct possibility, and thus kept its full strength available for the war to come. Downside, it sent the U.S. looking inwards even more than usual at a critical juncture. The giant didn't so much go to sleep as it did retreat to its lair to lick its wounds. But okay, enough rumination, let's get into the history. Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in on March 4, 1933, and by the time he put his hand on the Bible, there was a plan of action for that very first day. Priority one was to use a loose interpretation of existing legislation that I described last week to shut down the banking system across the nation. Second was to call a special session of Congress to get them approving new legislation immediately. Lastly, major figures in the banking sector on the East Coast would be summoned immediately to begin coordinating directly with the White House. As aghast as conservatives in both parties were at the gall of the federal government ordering the banking sector to shut down, there wasn't much argument when the holiday was announced on Sunday, March 5th. Nor would they have enough time to properly react, as it was set to start on Monday the 6th and run for 4 days. Which might seem like a small window, but there was a bigger plan brewing already. Treasury Secretary Wooten confirmed on the 6th that special legislation would be in place by the 9th for Congress to pass that would address the banking crisis overall. That isn't to say that even the 4-day gap wouldn't have repercussions. When I say banks were closed, I mean closed completely, in an age where people had only cash or checks. people could not get spending money out of their accounts, forcing people to rely on credit and informal tabs, and barring that, they had to resort to bartering. Businesses that ran out of small denominations had to turn away customers with large bills simply because they couldn't provide change. Keep in mind, life doesn't just stop amidst the big events. The day-to-day rhythm of life had to continue somehow. In most of the nation, this was doable, although patience in Michigan was exhausted as they had been experiencing those conditions for almost a month already, thanks to their regional banking crisis going so out of control. After less than 2 days, Wooten did make allowances for limited withdrawals to allow spending money for the necessities, but it goes to show how fragile everything was. The formulation of the Emergency Banking Act, which was to be presented on the 9th, was a proposal put together by the Treasury Department under Hoover, but never considered by the White House for implementation. Its contents were straightforward, basically all the ad hoc power being utilized to keep the banks closed and planned to be used to manage their reopening would be formalized as an amendment to the original Trading with the Enemy Act that they were using as cover. The idea was that once in place, the banks would be gradually reopened, with the soundest institutions opened first, and once it was determined the coast was clear with that group, to allow the next most reliable banks to reopen. Not all the banks would be allowed to be reopened, as those deemed lost causes would be taken into federal receivership and wound down, their assets liquidated. That wasn't an unusual outcome either. Around 4,000 banks were dissolved by the end of the year. If you ever pay any mind to the history of the American banking system and how it went from a dispersed constellation of countless local enterprises to being defined by a small number of national giants, it was here. The Depression caused that. And the Emergency Banking Act formalized a permanent consolidation, discouraging a return to the chaotic and freewheeling past. The act would also pave the way for the effective abandonment of the gold standard. Part of the powers included in the legislation was in giving the executive branch control of the nation's gold supply. Without getting too far ahead of myself, on April 5th, just a month later, Roosevelt would use the act's powers to issue Executive Order 6102, which prohibited the private ownership of large amounts of gold. You could still buy it for commercial or personal purposes, like, say, jewelry or artwork, but owning a stash of coins or gold bars was made illegal. The dollar was still pegged to gold, although even that would change in just a year's time, but paper money would no longer be redeemable for gold. That went for foreign purchases as well. All business would be handled in greenbacks going forward. Passage of the act through Congress was not a major hurdle. Democrats were raring for action, and the fact that the House of Representatives as a collective group had to be read the contents from the single copy of the legislation available wasn't actually a sticking point. While they voted, additional copies were hustled to the Senate in preparation for them to receive the act. The bill was voted on, approved by Congress, and signed by FDR on the 9th, just as planned. The House had started voting at 1 p.m., and it was on FDR's desk by 8:36 that evening. Over at the Treasury, Wooten arranged a plan where $200 million would be printed up for the sole purpose of propping up the banks once they were reopened. They might only have been reopening the reliable banks, but chances weren't to be taken if panic set back in immediately. This was their best, maybe even only, chance of restoring public confidence in the banking system. If they dropped the ball here, it could cripple everything else to come. Luckily for the Treasury Department, Roosevelt was an excellent pitchman. The bank holiday was extended to Monday the 13th, and that Sunday FDR sat down for the first of his fireside chats. They occupy a special place in the national memory, but they were actually fairly rare. He only did them a few times a year. In a nationwide radio address, he broke down in straightforward terms just what the legislation was designed to achieve, and he personally reassured the people that their money would be secure. The people responded, and when the banks reopened on the 13th, money started pouring back into them. The great financial crisis that had started in 1929 was effectively concluded, and the first step on a long road had been taken. And it wasn't going to be without its bumps, and even before the banking sector had been fully sorted out, FDR started ruffling feathers in his own camp. The cause was going to be one of the most contentious issues of the New Deal era, government spending. Roosevelt was himself not a fiscal revolutionary. His desire was to see a government operating within its means, even with the ambitious programs to come. And just because his most prominent lieutenants swung more towards progressive policies, that didn't mean he didn't have some conservatives whispering in his ear. Notable was one Lewis Douglas, FDR's initial budget director, and a member of the Democrats' conservative wing. He was considered a threat, especially by Tugwell, and Moley commented that he was as rigorously dedicated to orthodox fiscal policies as was Grover Cleveland, the late 1800s president. Tugwell warned against Douglas's cost-cutting ideas at a moment when government spending was paramount, but Roosevelt liked the idea of a lean and efficient federal government carrying out the work of reform. On Friday, May 10th, the day after the passage of the Emergency Banking Act, but still before the actual banks had started reopening, he sent Congress another emergency measure to pass. This one would cut $500 million in spending from the budget, which at the time ran around $3.6 billion annually, so it was a huge chunk. It was kind of incredible in light of how FDR was later portrayed as the big government champion. The plan was for agencies to be made smaller, salaries and pensions were to be slashed, and concernedly, it slashed veteran pensions in half, which was a dicey move given that the drama of the bonus army had only just played out less than a year previously. Hell, there were still dead enders from the bonus army still milling about D.C. with nowhere else to go. Many Democrats in the House refused to support the cuts, and it was only pushed through when conservative Democrats and Republicans made an alliance. The Senate hurried it through in order to take up legislation they were much more interested in that was right behind that, which was a bill to conditionally re-legalize the sale of beer and wine. More on that in a bit. The Economy Act, as it was known, was passed on March 20th, and FDR wasted little time cutting salaries by 15% across the board. That included Congress, too, just to show he wasn't fooling around. The cuts to veteran spending were immediately unpopular, and veterans groups quickly went into action lobbying Congress to reverse the cuts. It would take an entire year, but Congress would eventually rally to do so and even overrode FDR when he vetoed the change. While that incident in March 1934 would change Roosevelt's view on deficit spending and convince him to just, you know, give in and open the wallet, it was an entire year after his administration kicked off, and after the scale of what he was doing had probably sunk in. He wanted big projects and big programs, and the contradiction between his desire for that and conservative spending was frankly insurmountable. He would have to choose, even if he delayed committing to what he'd obviously have to do for as long as he could. It would take time for him to acclimate to the idea that government spending was the only thing available that could stimulate the economy, induce people to consume more, and thus create more economic activity, which would finally expand the tax base, thus paying for itself over time. Or rather, that's the nice way of looking at it. The harsher critique is that he realized the only thing keeping the economy from falling apart was government spending. Conditions were such that the free market couldn't accomplish that task on its own. The Economy Act was not the only initiative FDR had in mind to ram through Congress up front. I mentioned activity concerning beer and wine a moment ago. Well, FDR wanted to hurry up Prohibition's already in progress rollback. Accounts say that right before the first fireside chat on the 12th, he finished up a dinner with his aides by commenting, "Now I think it would be a good time for beer." A little double meaning there. The lame duck Congress had already voted to repeal Prohibition, aka the 18th Amendment. The problem was that its repeal was done through the 21st Amendment, which, as a constitutional one, would also need to be ratified by three-quarters of the states, which was going to take some time there. In the meantime, Congress did modify the Volstead Act, the legislation establishing prohibition in the first place, so that new allowances were made in the sale of booze, specifically allowing beer of less than 3.2% alcohol content to be sold in stores. That low in alcohol content was considered to be non-intoxicating, or at least it was considered that way by those modifying the law. Just take their word for it. FDR asserted that it would boost tax revenue, which was sorely needed as every little bit was going to be required to secure federal spending. What was striking to Roosevelt about these first few pieces of legislation was the ease in which his administration was able to overcome what had previously been intimidating obstacles. He had established federal oversight of the banking sector, and he had laid low the veterans and temperance lobbies. The initial frenzy of reform that we now call the first 100 days wasn't a plan undertaken by the administration. Again, that's all historical hindsight. Nobody knew for sure how far the administration could go, and the special session of Congress that had been called was intended really just to pass that first batch of legislation. But after only a couple of weeks, he had enjoyed only success, and FDR wanted to make use of the momentum while he still had it. Instead of slowing down, the tempo of reform would only increase. Best to strike while the iron was hot and all that. The next item on the agenda had been formulated by FDR in the morning of March 14th, only a day after some of the banks had been reopened. He pitched the idea that to address the problem of unemployed young men, a Civilian Conservation Corps, or the CCC, would be formed. This agency would recruit people, organize them into work crews, and send them out onto the extensive federal lands of the nation to develop them. And by develop, I mean improve infrastructure. That includes basics like roads and bridges, as well as flood and fire control measures. The idea was to both get 250,000 young men out and working, while also beautifying the nation's wilderness and making it more accessible to the public, a particular joy for the conservation-minded FDR. He had initiated a statewide program along the same lines as Governor of New York, which I touched on a couple weeks ago, so he was also sticking with what he knew. His team went into action and had the first sketch of a bill ready by the evening of the 14th. This effort would be a little more complex than previous reforms, as it would require four different federal departments working together, which was entirely necessary because there were logistical concerns of taking 250,000 men and deploying them to the most undeveloped parts of the country. Men would be selected based on unemployment records, age, and marital status. They were looking for unmarried men as family weren't getting shipped out with them. Pay was $1 a day, which wasn't great, but lodging and food were taken care of at least. Although lodging sometimes mounted to tents or a shack while on the job, and I can't imagine the food being exemplary either. And the pay did at least beat what the public welfare was offering, and you could arrange to have much of it given to your immediate family back home. Which is to say, if you were a young man being sent out west, your unemployed and possibly starving parents and siblings could have something coming in. FDR was ready to present the plan by March 21st, and in just 8 days, Congress had passed a law to establish the CCC. While the plan was fairly modest in its scope, FDR hinted in presenting it that more public works programs were on the way. Some tut-tutted the government getting involved in work creation, and William Green, the president of the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, the biggest labor coalition in the U.S., said the plan had tones of both fascism and communism. That wasn't the majority opinion, though, and the CCC rapidly became a popular element of the emerging New Deal. Youths from all over the country flocked to the banner starting on April 7th, with 3 million serving from 1933 to 1942, when the program was wound down on account of World War II. By July, 1,300 camps had formed and 275,000 people had signed up. Little side note, a second bonus expeditionary force of veterans organized itself and traveled to Washington in May 1933 to try again at demanding relief to their destitution. FDR, not falling into the same trap that had helped ruin Hoover, welcomed them with open arms. Help was provided in setting up an encampment for them, food was handed out, and law enforcement left them alone. The veterans commented that when Hoover sent in the cavalry, Roosevelt sent his wife Eleanor. The president's offer to them was to waive the age and marital requirements for joining the CCC, and 25,000 men signed up on the spot, dispersing the second BEF almost overnight, and, well, just showing that FDR was a far better politician than Hoover was. The experiences of those who participated in the CCC went a long way towards mending the nation. Not only was it popular with the public at large, but those who enrolled later recalled their experiences with pride. These were both city and country kids getting thrown together from all corners of the nation, going to places they otherwise never would have dreamed of seeing, meeting people they otherwise would have never met. They were provided with fresh clothes, and for many, the three meals a day they received was a luxury they had never known, even during the supposed good times. The usual worker was in their very late teens and early 20s, so basically college age, and on average stayed on for 9 months, over the course of which they gained 30 pounds, not because they were being force-fed and fattened, but just because they started off critically underweight and malnourished. Three simple meals, and let me tell you, this is even taking into consideration that portions would not have been comparable to modern plates, did wonders for their health. the work they did had actual meaning as well. They were working on something other than a soul-crushing enterprise. Just to rattle off some numbers, they built up 125,000 miles of road, almost 49,000 bridges, laid 89,000 miles of telephone lines, and planted 3 billion trees. If you ever wonder what our nation can do to rejuvenate its wildlife and expand its forests, especially in this era of climate crisis, we have a very clear-cut historical answer sitting right there. And this program even ties into World War II directly. Much of the actual leadership and organization rested with the Army. The project leaders were all Army officers, and the camps were run with no small amount of martial discipline. While, yes, it did give many youths a taste of Army life, this was still years away from war, and it would be a younger crop of men doing most of the fighting. A much bigger deal was that it gave Army officers practical, in-the-field experience in leading and organizing men. Yes, you could train and do war games, but these were long-term efforts out in the boonies where, as a leader, you had to have a degree of self-sufficiency and decision-making capability. And you were working with youngsters that fit the perfect demographic for conscript age. And for the War Department as a whole, they gained a lot of experience in logistics and deploying hundreds of thousands of men into remote and undeveloped areas. In World War II, a big strength of the United States was its crazy good logistics and organizational capabilities. The CCC actually helped a little bit with that. Then Colonel George C. Marshall, who would become head of the Army during World War II, was in charge of organizing 19 camps in Georgia and Florida, and he would personally establish many connections with the Roosevelt administration during this period. And while Union leadership had initially opposed the idea, they quickly came around. The actual head of the CCC, even with the Army having its hand in much of it, was entrusted to Robert Fechner, who was a leading member of the AFL and had worked with FDR back during their World War I days, which, yes, that appointment was sort of an olive branch to the AFL. Even William Green came around by August when he was invited to tour CCC camps with Roosevelt himself. Green was impressed enough by both the agency and the invitation that he dropped his opposition. Now, obviously, not everybody that was unemployed was a young male of high school or early college age, nor could everybody be sent out into the nation's hinterlands to do manual labor. But FDR's experience as governor of New York had already given him a template of public relief to stabilize what was, even after taking office, a critical situation. The common family was in dire straits and needed relief straight away, if only to head off starvation. Which is why, next week, we will pick up the story of the first 100 days by talking about legislation to provide relief, work, and to reform the devastated farming sector. Join me then, and as always, thank you very much for listening.